Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Barracuda Networks, innovators of network security and data protection solutions designed to thwart cyber threats and data loss for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at barracuda.com/KQED.
What to do with an extra $6.7 billion? That is the happy question Governor Jerry Brown pondered this week.
The state is definitely on the rebound from just a few years ago when the state was mired in red ink.
To what do we owe this huge windfall, and how long will the good times roll? Also, they conjure up some of our worst fears, sex offenders living in our communities. But they are not always who you imagine them to be.
I don't care about what society thinks. As long as I know what my family thinks, they love me and I know who I am, I'm fine with it. I wish it didn't happen, don't get me wrong, but this is the card I'm dealt with. So it is what it is.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. So you got to think Jerry Brown is feeling pretty good this week. The man inherited a huge budget deficit 5 years ago, after all, and This week he kind of looks like a turnaround artist. The governor revealed that since January, California has taken in $6.7 billion more than was projected just in January. So, time to divvy up the spoils, right? Not quite.
The idea that when you get a little money, or a lot of money, for a few years, that now you've reached utopia is so demonstrably false, as evidenced by the last 12 years. So we have to learn from history and not keep repeating the mistakes.
Most of that extra cash will go to schools and community colleges. That's required by law. But UC students get a tuition freeze under the governor's plan, and low-income folks would get a tax break to put some extra cash in their pockets. It is, no matter how you slice it, a very good news budget, all of it driven by a strong economy. How strong? We'll put that question to Christopher Thornburg, co-founder of Beacon Economics. So, Chris, first of all, how broad is this recovery?
We added last year 1 out of 6 jobs in the U.S. We added 100,000 more jobs in Texas. It's not just San Francisco and San Jose. It's broad-based. Third fastest growing big economy, Fresno. Fourth, Inland Empire. So it's a huge resurgence in the state economy. Lots of different sectors moving forward. It's great news.
It is. And put that $7 billion or so in context. I mean, is that historically speaking, is that a big jump?
Yeah, that's a pretty big jump. We're talking roughly 7%, if you will, of overall general fund revenues. That's big. Part of this is, again, the missing the job numbers, which has been happening over the last couple of years. Part of this is also that Jerry Brown has been and continues to be a very careful fiscal
frugal
leader. Frugal, fiscal, whatever you want to call it. Yes. Well, not cheap. No, smart. Because look what happened in the late 90s. You had a Gray Davis administration sitting on top of gazoogles of money coming in based what most people understood were on temporary
sources.
The dot-com boom. And no one was ever careful. They went to town, threw all sorts of money and all sorts of prep projects, candidly created a hole that the state is still trying to dig out from under.
Because they spent it on long-term expenses.
Exactly.
Like
not the least of, exactly. Not the least of which was completely undermining all of Pete Wilson's hard-earned pension reforms in the beginning of the 90s. Our current Governor Brown, he won't do that. It's not that kind of politician. He's not going to allow these good times to cloud the long-term situation, which is still not good. And that's what this revise says.
Why do you say not good?
The reason this is not what I would call a good longer term fiscal situation is really twofold. First of all, remember, a big hunk of this surplus is coming from those temporary tax increases that were put in place under Prop 30 a couple of years ago. Those are going away in the not too distant future. That's one thing we have to worry about.
Unless they're renewed,
right. Second thing is, we're still heavily relying on personal income taxes, which is still a heavily progressive tax, which means we tax high-income earners a lot, Now, you know, don't get me wrong, as a member of the what I would call sort of upper middle class, soak the rich, please do. I love it. But we also have to remember this is an incredibly unstable source of income because so much of it is based on capital gains. And you know what? What the capital markets give it, the capital markets take it away very rapidly.
There's a lot of pressure on the governor to do something about income inequality in California. We're hearing this all over the country. And one thing the governor has done is he's proposing an earned income tax credit. It would cost the state about $380 million. As policies go toward helping lower income folks, where would you put that one?
Very high up the list. I think it's a great idea. Because what it does is it helps lower paid workers without taxing employers and consumers, if you will, which is what, say, a minimum wage does.
So it rewards work.
It rewards work and it doesn't disincentivize employment, which is so very important. We have a bad working poor problem in the United States. It's particularly bad here in California. Obviously, it's something we need to work on. But what worries me about this is I think this is a small step in the right direction. But that's it. It's small.
So, Chris, if you were king for a day or two in California, what would you like to see done in terms of economic policy, budget policy that, you know, you could just do with a wave of a wand?
Right. Obviously, pension reform. Pensions today are so overblown. Wages being earned by the public union so overblown compared to the public sector, private sector. That's the first thing I'd do. Second thing would be a complete overhaul of the revenue system. I would
– Less reliance on income tax.
Much less reliance on income tax. I'd flatten that quite a bit. I'd get rid of Prop 13, have across the board, say, 2% tax on property tax. And I would cut the sales tax way down and offset that by an increase in creation of a service sales tax. It's not about being overtaxed. It's not about high taxes. It's about dumb taxes. And that's the conversation we need to have.
All right. We'll put that on a bumper sticker.
Absolutely.
Christopher Thornburg, founding partner of Beacon Economics in Los Angeles. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Well, all that extra state money is due in part to the booming tech industry in California. That's great, but tell it to a homeless person in San Francisco who can't even get online. That's because most public spaces have no Wi-Fi, and libraries are pretty much the only place they can use a computer. But one homeless guy had a suggestion. Why not get local tech companies to help put free Wi-Fi in the city's shelters? As Sam Harnett reports, his idea is picking up steam.
Sometimes when Wayne Samuelson takes a look around, he feels left behind, like he's living in another era.
Everybody's just wired up. People are like, are you connected? I'm like, what do you mean? Am I a gangster? No. What does that mean? Oh, connected, you know, internet.
Samuelson is a Marines veteran. He's been homeless on and off since the early 90s. It's been hard for him to keep up with the latest tech trends.
About maybe a month ago, I finally figured out what a selfie stick was. I saw these people walking around with these sticks, and I'm like, are they back scratchers? What the heck are they doing with the sticks?
The digital divide usually isn't so funny. Samuelson became homeless after losing his job as a museum security guard. Without internet, it's been difficult to find housing, communicate with family, and get jobs. He's been going door to door and scouring help wanted ads in newspapers.
We're behind. We're behind the times, like primitive.
Samuelson's been staying at the Next Door shelter for the last few weeks. The director, Kathy Chajari, shows me the cramped, bare-bones living quarters.
You don't get to get away here. You know, you're sleeping beside someone that could, you know, talk to themselves, smell, scary, you know them, you don't know them.
Chajari says the shelter lost tons of city funding after the 2008 financial crisis. She says she had to scrounge for bedding and cleaning supplies. Eventually, she was forced to close the computer lab.
This is a world unto itself.
No internet, right here in the heart of San Francisco. Residents would crowd windows on one side of the shelter, hoping to pick up some shred of Wi-Fi signal from nearby businesses.
We were trying to use the Monarch Hotel across the street. It was real sketchy.
Scott Nelson has been at the shelter for almost 120 days. He says internet should be a public utility.
It's a required thing, and cities should provide it. It's as a vital utility, sort of like water.
Even though the economy's improved since 2008, internet is still scarce for the homeless. Some shelters in California have computers, but most don't have Wi-Fi. Many are complete internet dead zones. So was Nextdoor until just a few weeks ago when shelter resident Darcell Jackson had an idea.
I was laying in bed over there in my bed thinking, what could tech people do for homeless people? And I was sitting there at night, I was like, wow, we could use Wi-Fi here. That's something they could do.
Jackson read an article about Greg Gottman. The former tech CEO had written a screed against the poor and homeless on Facebook. He called them hyenas, lower parts of society that should keep to themselves. He said, quote, "It's a burden having them so close to us." More than a year later, Gottman held a town hall meeting on homelessness, looking for solutions, seeking redemption. Jackson decided to go.
And it really wasn't geared for homeless people. It was for people to pat themselves on the back for what they were already doing.
That didn't stop Jackson. He approached Gottman and told him about his idea to put Wi-Fi in shelters. Gottman liked it, and together they contacted a local internet provider, Monkey Brains, which donated time and equipment. It cost the company about $6,000 to hook up the whole shelter. Suddenly, Jackson could message his kids.
Facebook, that's the way I keep in contact with my family. I have an 8-year-old son. I go on Facebook. I had his mom set up a Facebook page, and that's the way we communicate.
Now Jackson's got big plans. He's working with Gottman to create a nonprofit, Shelter Tech. He got some smartphones donated and hopes to get Wi-Fi at public housing projects and other shelters around the city. It's made a big difference so far at Next Door Shelter, says Wayne Samuelson. People are more connected, empowered, happier.
I hear him talking, "Do you have any movies on your phone?" And they're like, "Yeah, well, show me because I want to watch some movies." So it brings joy into a very dull and mundane life.
Samuelson now has something to be very happy about.
2 days ago, I finally got a job. If I didn't have the capacity to be online, I wouldn't be able to get the job.
He found the new security guard job on Craigslist. He says his new employers are taking a chance on him. Without the internet, they wouldn't even know he existed. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett.
So for this next story, we have a bit of a warning. It contains some explicit language you might find offensive or inappropriate for children. In the past few months, we've brought you stories on the growing number of inmates being released from state prisons, including lifers serving time for murder. Today on the California Report, we're going to focus on one group of parolees who, you might say, spark stronger negative feelings than any other.
I'm a sex offender. I touched my daughter. She was under 14. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but she was under 14. She was young. She was too young, and it was stupid.
Indecent exposure was my charges, and I had multiple charges. But like I said, my offenses weren't towards any kids or anything like that.
We'll return to those two men in just a minute, but first some context. There are about 6,000 sex offenders on parole in California. Their crimes range from rape to indecent exposure. Until recently, state law prevented all registered sex offenders from living within a half a mile of parks or schools where children gather. But the state Supreme Court recently found that that blanket limitation on housing was too restrictive. As a result, many sex offenders will soon be more integrated into neighborhoods. So it seemed like a good time to learn more about how the state keeps track of registered sex offenders out in the community. We're in the parking lot outside the state parole office in San Francisco, where Agent Fernando Mata oversees the tracking of sex offenders paroled to the city. He's dressed casually, jeans and a bulky black hoodie that hides his badge, and a Smith & Wesson 40 gun is attached to his side. I asked him to describe what's in the trunk of his car.
Radios, I have urinalysis test, I have paperwork, gloves, a tactical vest that I use, my lunch.
We hop inside a state-issued Ford Fusion and head off for a few unannounced visits to sex offenders on parole. I asked him what a typical day is like. Mata says he's always in an investigative mode.
As soon as I open my computer, I'm looking to see who's in the low battery, whose charging history is looking different than it was yesterday. You know, and if so, why? What's happening?
Mata says the agents he supervises in San Francisco each keep tabs on about 30 to 35 sex offenders. The agents look for changes in daily tracking patterns, hints that could point to things like drug use, staying out all night, signs of trouble. Our first stop is an apartment building in an up-and-coming industrial neighborhood near the edge of San Francisco Bay.
Oh, there he is.
Hey! What's going on? I was going to send you an email today.
How's everything going? Sort of. Come on in.
Okay. Dan, we're just going to use their first names here at the state's request. Dan invites us into his apartment. Agent Mata walks around, opening drawers, poking around for things that might raise a flag. Then he asks Dan to lift his pant leg so he can see the GPS bracelet on his ankle.
How's the device working?
Oh, fine. I got a new charger. You know, the cord thing.
How many chargers do you have?
Just the one.
Sex offender parolees have to keep these tracking devices on at all times. Batteries charged.
It's not too tight. It's a good thing.
No, it's actually fine, yeah. It gives me enough space to put this.
And you can hear it when it beeps?
Pretty faint, but, you know.
Probably because you have two socks over it.
Probably, yeah.
I ask him how he feels after more than 2 years on parole, still having to wear the bracelet until his parole is up.
I'm used to it after all this time, but it is an annoyance. So it's okay. I wish it was smaller. You know, I can never wear shorts if I don't want it to be exposed. And I don't want it to be exposed because that puts me at risk out there.
Dan is a professional photographer, and his apartment is pretty nice. Not the kind of living on the edge I imagine for a sex offender. He lives with a girlfriend. His parole conditions require telling her about his past and the limitations on what he can do and who he can see. No contact with anyone under the age of 18.
The difficulty there is I do have a granddaughter who's 5 or 6 who lives down in San Luis Obispo County with my youngest son, and I've never met her, and I can't wait until I'm able to meet her. That'll be the first thing that I do is go let her meet Grandpa, you know?
Dan spent more than 4 years in prison for molesting his wife's daughter, and under California law, his name and address is listed on a state website. I ask him if he wonders whether any of the neighbors in his building know about his record.
I told them. They didn't know, but I told them because I do walk their dog. So I told them the whole story, and they were fine with it.
When you say they're fine with it, what does that mean?
That means they're okay. They know me as a person. They know that I'm not an extreme pedophile.
After a short visit with Dan, Agent Mata and I get back into the car and head off. I ask him about one thing that struck me.
You know, I would never guess if I met him that he was, you know, had molested his daughter at one point in his life. Is that typical of sex offenders where, you know, you kind of, they seem like, quote unquote, average guys?
They do. They come in all shapes and sizes. This particular individual, yeah, he looks like your next door neighbor, you know, somebody you would never expect.
We drive a mile or so to our next stop, a guy who was caught exposing himself to women 5 times over the course of 7 years. In parks, libraries.
My offenses weren't towards any kids or anything like that. You know, I flashed my penis in front of women.
His first name is Diaris. He's dressed in sweatpants and a pajama top. He walks along as Agent Mata looks through his grandfather's house where Diaris lives.
That's a bathroom. It's a closet. And then this is Grandpa's room here. Everything looks good, man. No changes?
No.
Afterwards, he talks about what happened when he was 4 years old, something his aunt did to him that, he says, contributed to his criminal behavior.
I remember she used to take showers and have me take showers and have me lay on top of her. But being 4 years old, I don't think nothing's wrong with that. But like I said, I didn't have any outlets, people to talk to or, you know, I didn't have that.
Diarra says he went through a tough period after his conviction, spiraling down into depression.
Went to jail. Like I said, I never understood. So I had some violations, went back a few times. And then after that, my last time when I got out, my agent Mata got me a job at this hotel, and I've been on the straight and narrow ever since.
Diarra seems resigned to being a registered sex offender for the rest of his life.
I don't care about what society thinks. As long as I know what my family thinks. They love me and I know who I am. I'm fine with it. I wish it didn't happen. Don't get me wrong, but this is the card I'm dealt with. So it is what it is.
Parole agents like Fernando Mata keep daily tabs on sex offenders in California. But big picture policy, that falls to the California Sex Offender Management Board. And we're joined now by its chair, Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley. Thanks for joining us.
Yes.
Well, first of all, one of the takeaways from that piece we just heard is that you really can't paint all sex offenders with the same brush. You know, a rapist, for example, not the same as someone who, say, had sex with a consenting 16-year-old when they were 18 or 19. So my first question is, how do you evaluate the threat to public safety by any given individual sex offender in the community?
California has mandated that
sex offenders who are in our community who are under supervision are required to undergo a risk assessment called the Static 99. This is a validated tool that really gives a level of a risk that somebody would be in the community for reoffending.
Until recently, Jessica's law, which voters passed, prohibited all sex offenders, regardless of their offense, from living within a half a mile or so of a park or a school where kids gather. The state Supreme Court recently loosened that, said that could not be applied in a blanket way to all sex offenders. In your opinion, does that decision make us more or less safe?
Residency restrictions are not a guarantee of safety, and they're not a guarantee that a person will not reoffend. For one reason, a majority of victims who are sexually assaulted, whether they're a child or an adult or a teen, they know the perpetrator. And so having a residency restriction doesn't necessarily mean that they'll have no contact with someone who is a sex offender or who has been convicted of that. And then the other flaw is that if somebody can't live within 2,000 feet of a park or a place where kids would congregate, it doesn't mean that they can't go to the park. It means they can't live there. So residency restrictions doesn't necessarily keep people away from the places where they might go to try to get access to children or other people. And then the last thing that we found was that one of the ways in which sex offenders are able to remain crime-free is to have stability and housing. And what residency restrictions did was that it drove a lot of people into a state of homelessness, couch surfing, or transient. And that instability in your housing can oftentimes be a factor in somebody who then ultimately will reoffend.
Can make it harder to track them, too.
It does make it harder to track them.
My understanding is that California, unlike most states, requires a lifetime registration for sex offenders. And some people feel that sort of unfairly taints people and treats all sex offenders the same. What are your thoughts about that?
We have to prioritize and we have to be more articulate in terms of how we are identifying people who need to register. So the Sex Offender Management Board has published a paper on the efficacy of tiered registration, looking at misdemeanor level registration, which would not require lifetime registration, all the way to individuals who should register for life because their crimes have shown that they're so dangerous that they need to be under supervision or under someone's watchful eye.
Nancy O'Malley, Alameda County District Attorney and Chair of the California Sex Offender Management Board. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Try, if you can, to picture the land all the way from downtown Los Angeles to Catalina Island. It's hard to imagine today, but the dominant culture there was once the Tongva people. Today, the Tongvan descendants have dwindled, maybe a couple thousand remain, and the tribe is still trying to get federal recognition. So while the region has been their home for millennia, some still struggle to find their place there. And that brings us to our series Between Homelands, where students from USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism are telling stories of people in California who have come from afar or who were born in the U.S. but feel like cultural foreigners. Stephanie Case tells us how one Tongvan woman found her sense of home.
Centuries separate Cindy Alvitre from her ancestors, but there's a place where she feels close to them, the ocean.
This is a comfort zone to me. The nature is a comfort zone. To go sit on a rock out at the end of the jetty, to go in the water, to watch the seals and the sea lions, and to just be back in the natural world.
The Tongvans were ocean people. They lived in huts by the beach, wore grass skirts and shells, and dove for abalone. Their stories are embedded in the sand Alvitre walks on. Her father made sure she would never forget.
I was always told, this is your home. Your ancestors are from this home. And this is where they were buried. And when he walked through there, he would tell us, shh, don't talk loud. This is a sacred place.
The most sacred place is Pavugna. It was the sprawling tribal land overlooking the Pacific. Now, one weekend a year, descendants from dozens of tribes gather there for a powwow to revive the land. As the sun dips down, drum circles pulsate like the culture's beating heart, alive. But most days, it's gone. Pavugna is now known as Long Beach. Alvitre and I are sitting by a parking lot at Cal State Long Beach, a piece of old Pavugna. There's noise and cars, not exactly sacred.
When I walk around, I live two worlds. The other one is a constant conversation with the nature and with the ancestors.
One night, those ancestors came to her in a dream.
And suddenly before me, there's the Saddleback Mountains. And in front of the mountains is a big mass of water, like a lake. And there's these boats in this water, huge boats made out of wood. And people are getting in them, and I'm telling everybody, paddle like this, paddle like this. And we're speaking in the Tongva language. So it was just this amazing vision of mountains that I grew up around in Orange County, but here's these boats I've never seen.
2 weeks later, she got a phone call from a man at the California Indigenous Maritime Association.
He says, so, do you know what a tiat is? And I'm like, not really. And he described the boat in my dreams. I was really blown away. And he says, are you interested in building one of these?
Alvitre crouches next to a tiat that she helped build, named Momat Ehiko, Tongan for breath of the ocean. With a brush, she paints a mahogany ochre onto the boat's side. A dozen other members of Alvitre's Tiat Society help with little repairs. Momat Ehiko is the only tiat in Southern California. All others are long gone.
It's probably a lot of them sank down in the middle of that ocean. So there you go. The ocean is, it's a sacred place.
The repairs are almost done. Soon, Alvitre will watch as her friends row the tiat out to sea, echoing the motions of their ancestors.
People are so disconnected. Momat Ehiko, she's our connect.
Out on the water, she and they will be home. For the California Report, I'm Stephanie Case in Long Beach.
Dumb. I'm YouTube singer Nick Patera, and you've been listening to The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Dan Bringer, Howard Gelman, Jim Bennett, and Rob Spate. The online team includes David Weir, Don Clyde, David Marks, Lisa Pickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price. Our interns are Michelle Dutro and Pio Zuveri. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Tyke Hendricks, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, and Holly Kernan. I'm Nick Patera, and for that other dude, Scott Schaefer, thanks for listening.
This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of children at risk in California.